take or sells off profitable parts of the company, the way Trump has sold America's resources and citizens to maximize his family's and friends' wealth, something no other president has ever done. Trump has been very successful at creating profit and chaos. Chaos doesn't require planning, depends on not planning, just thrashing about, lawsuits, program cuts, name-calling. Unlike on the old TV show, there's no one to tell Donnie, you're fired. Only us voters can do that. Assuming we get to vote. Since Donnie's handlers know a democratically controlled Congress would be an emergency to their national control, he'll just have to stop everyone from voting. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 1st, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, G, Dave Johnson, Hannah Francis, and Dan Raphael. The producer is Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Jill Freitas, Edwin J. Vieira, Isabel Charlet, Judith Ruiz Branch, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Gian Guanta. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Welcome to Street Roots Radio. Street Roots Radio is a collaboration between X-Ray FM, KBOO Radio, and local publication Street Roots. Today, the article that we are discussing is called Treated and Trapped. Patients with a unique legal status remain stuck at the Oregon State Hospital for months as a shortage of community beds and bureaucratic delays stall their exit. I have here with me Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas. Hi, Jake. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Hannah.
So your article addresses this interesting and kind of awful phenomenon where people are getting trapped in the state hospital for mental health treatment, even when they're getting told that they do not need to get treatment anymore. So can you just like sort of briefly summarize this in a little bit more depth about where they're getting stuck in this process and how long they're having to wait?
Right, so it is a really difficult, kind of really unusual circumstance that these individuals find themselves in. And it applies to about, the number fluctuates each month, but it hovers at about 40 more or less patients at the Oregon State Hospital who have been deemed ready for discharge or deemed ready for conditional discharge. And all of these patients, they fall under, they're called guilty except for insanity patients. And that's a really unique legal designation where it means that you committed a crime, but at the time you committed the crime, your thinking was clouded by some sort of mental disorder or some sort of, you know, mental illness, basically. So you're not actually responsible for your crime and you should get treatment instead of being sent to prison. And so for a lot of these patients, a lot of people who get this defense, they use the defense of guilty except for insanity. They usually end up in the state hospital, which is the state's psychiatric facility. While they're there, they get treatment. And the whole idea for a lot of them, or for most of them, is that if you give them enough treatment, help them manage their mental illness, that they can be released. to somewhere else. And that somewhere else, that can mean, that could be like a group home, like a residential facility where they can come and go, but they just have to check in with, you know, their caseworkers or staff there. Or it might be a secure residential treatment facility, which is a locked facility. In some cases, they might just have independent living where they don't have any of that. They can just live in an apartment and they just have to check in with, you know, people who are, you know, their providers or their case manager. But the problem is that right now we don't have enough of anything, of any of those settings, like the secure residential treatment facilities and the residential treatment facilities. So you have these people who don't need treatment at the hospital, which is the most expensive and restrictive mental health care you can get in the whole state of Oregon. So they're there taking up beds that are really needed elsewhere, really needed by other patients. And they just can't get out because there's just not enough beds in these other facilities.
So you kind of briefly touched on this, but about how many people are being affected by this?
So there's a lot of data that's on that comes out on the state hospital, and it's usually between 20 and 60 people each month are. They're deemed, they go through the process and they get the designation ready for conditional release. And the numbers also show that very few of them actually get the conditional release. So you have essentially dozens of people every month who are told you're ready for discharge. You are ready for the next steps. But then it's just like a trickle of how many actually get out. It's just like a couple a month.
You say that part of this is due to years of underfunding in the state mental health system. But then you also say that recently there was a lot of money poured into building more places for people to go when they're getting substance use treatment. But then there's not really much funding for the next step. Is that right?
Well, the state has underfunded the state's mental health system for a long time. For really decades now. And so the state realizes that this is a problem. And so the legislature, in the last couple of sessions, they've just approved these massive spending packages to build more of these less restrictive settings outside of the state hospital, like residential, homes or treatment homes or secure treatment facilities. So they've just poured money into this. And they have been steadily increasing the number of beds available. But the thing is, it just takes a while for these to get going. These facilities, you have to find a location for them, and you have to get it, make sure it's going to suit all your needs. And then a big thing that I don't think gets enough attention about it is that you have to get staff, and you have to get people who will staff these facilities, and you need providers. And that's I think is a huge impediment to getting all the treatment and care that people are going to need. So you really have this economy of scale that you need to build up, and it's not clear how long it'll take to do it. There was a 2024 study that gets cited a lot that the governor had a consulting firm put out. And the study found that basically the state needed to double its number of beds to more than 8,000 to meet the need. And it's around 4,000. And I believe that number includes the state hospital. So there's still a ways to go to get just some people call them step down facilities from the state hospital.
So you also mentioned a few people's experiences of going through these programs and sort of their reactions while they're in these hospitals, not being able to get out, and then also one's experience after they have been able to leave. So could you tell me a little bit about some of the experiences of people who are in the system?
Right. So I talked to people who are current patients at the state hospital. None of them wanted their names to be used because they're just in a very delicate situation and they don't want to attract any negative attention. And so so some of these people, they'll be told that they can leave, but then, so they just can't find a step down facility, and they'll do interviews with, home, And maybe they just don't get through the interview process because they just it's not a right fit. And or some of these patients, they have medical need that they need a facility to be able to handle their medical needs. Right. And so they might need the right staff who can help them manage their medications or their treatment plan. And so it's not like just one bed fits all. Like they just need it to be the right fit. And I was also told in reporting this that people want to be released into the Portland area. That's where they want to find these step down facilities. But there's more demand for those versus like maybe a group home in Eastern Oregon, which might be really far away from your family and support network and just anything else. So it's not like you just build one bed fit and it fits all. And I talked to one patient who was like really a success story, I would say, where they, while they were in the state hospital, they were, they really got treatment. They really just learned some ways to manage their mental health symptoms. They started journaling. They, they got into religion, started reading their Bible and praying. And so it sounded like they just had so much better ways of coping with things. This person got cleared for discharge, but they had to wait for like a year and some change the whole time they were there. But I asked this person like how they dealt with it all. They said they dealt with it very well. Like they said that they just, trusted that this was part of God's plan. And they eventually got out and they're in a good group home. They get 30 minutes out a day. It's just small things that I think people forget that you suddenly have control over. Like this person was saying that they have a TV in their room and they can have their dental glue in their room and just things that you wouldn't even think about. And the person comes from a native community and they're, they're hoping to attend powwows soon and go to church and connect with family. And so I think this person's experience, it speaks to that it's important to get out of the state hospital. Like when you don't need that level of treatment, because when you get out, you can be closer to, it's kind of the life you had before, with your family and your community and things you're interested in. You can just kind of move on with your life a little bit more and not be stuck in the most expensive and regimented place.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Another important distinction and sort of dynamic that you lay out is the dynamic between the aid and assist patients and the guilty except for insanity patients. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yes. So there's a big difference between the two. There's been a big rise in aid and assist patients over the years. And what their legal status is that they don't understand the legal proceedings against them. They've been accused of a crime, but they're just they're just not mentally well enough that they can understand what's happening. And so there's been like this litigation that's been hanging over the state hospital for like over 20 years now. And there's a court order that says from the litigation that states that if you're deemed an aid and assist, that you need to be restored to competency to face charges. You need to be admitted to the state hospital within 7 days. And the whole idea of that is that people with mental illness shouldn't be in jail. They should be in the state hospital. And so what that has done is that it's just put a lot of pressure on the state hospital, that there's just not enough beds. And now the state has fallen out of compliance with that 7-day requirement, that people are just not getting into the state hospital within the 7 days that's required under the court order. And now there's a contempt order that's produced like over $1 million in fines against the state. And meanwhile, we have like these 40 or so people, it fluctuates, but people who are deemed ready to get out of there and they have nowhere to go. And if you could open up those 40 beds, that would go pretty long ways to relieving pressure on the state hospital.
Right. And so these people have nowhere to go. And you kind of touch on this at the end of your article, but whose fault is this?
That's a good question. I think one of the takeaways from the story is that I put this question about the state, the spokesperson for the health authority, which is in charge of the state hospital, as well as the the Psychiatric Security Review Board, which is this quasi-judicial panel that's in charge of guilty except for insanity patients. And so I asked both of them, who's responsible for making sure that guilty except for insanity patients are discharged from the state hospital? And neither one of them, they both cited the litigation against the state hospital, but both of them just didn't answer the question.
I'm curious if you'll share some more of the different opinions about whether this is kind of standard practice or whether this is not right and not good for people. You reference a couple mental health spokespeople, including Martha Sills, who's the health authority spokesperson. You say that she didn't reply to a lot of your questions.
Yeah, they didn't. I mean, the spokesperson, they cited litigation against the state hospital. And so that was kind of expected. But I think I think nobody thinks this is a good situation, and including the state. And so because of all the litigation, there's been a lot more scrutiny on the state hospital, and that's meant there's been more documents and a lot more data produced about just conditions and operations of the state hospital. And they've also, it's also meant the appointment of an independent monitor or expert, which is this psychiatrist, Dr. Deborah Pinals. And she's produced these reports scrutinizing operations at the state hospital. And she's called this out, saying that the guilty except for insanity patients who are stuck at the state hospital, that's just not acceptable, and that they really need to speed up their processes to get this population out. So the state is well aware of this. They know this problem's there. It's been called out. And what I think is notable is that in one of her reports, Deborah Pinals, she references the Olmstead decision, which is it's this legal standard, federal legal standard, where someone with a disability should not be kept away from the broader community. That you can't just take people who have disabilities and just hide them away in an institution or somewhere, that they need to be getting services in a community setting, and not. So that was bad. So the Olmstead decision basically just means that people with disabilities should be getting services in close to a community setting as they can, and not just institutionalized and just sequestered away from everyone else. And she says that what they're doing with the guilty except for insanity patients who are ready for discharge, that is a clear violation of the Olmstead, of the Olmstead standard.
And then what does Disability Rights Oregon have to say about all of this?
Disability Rights Oregon, they're a pretty influential advocacy group in the state. And they have lawyers, and they're the ones that are actually leading the litigation, or been the ones leading the litigation against the state hospital. They say that this is, when I interviewed them, they said that this is really it just means that people's lives are put on hold when they're ready for discharge, but they can't leave. And it doesn't make much sense when you have this crisis situation where there's a lack of beds at the state hospital for aid and assist patients. But meanwhile, you have patients who don't need to be there.
So where can people find this article if they're interested in reading more?
They should go find a vendor, Street Roots vendor.
Thank you so much for your time, Jake.
Of course.
You've been listening to an interview with Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas about his recent article, Treated and Trapped. Patients with a unique legal status remain stuck at the Oregon State Hospital for months as a shortage of community beds and bureaucratic delays stall their exit. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News reporter G. For the evening news, I interviewed Namisha Jane, Pride in Numbers Community Outreach Lead. Pride in Numbers is a community-led research project conducting a statewide survey of Two-Spirit and LGBTQIA+ Oregonians. I spoke to Namisha to learn more.
Pride in Numbers is a community-led statewide research project by and for Two-Spirit and LGBTQIA+ people across Oregon. It's resourced for us and by us. We're creating a powerful portrait of Two-Spirit and LGBTQI plus life in Oregon through an online survey, storytelling sessions and interviews, as well as a community art project.
Could you share a little bit more about why Pride in Numbers was formed?
Oregon is, you know, widely seen as an LGBTQI plus friendly and affirming state, especially compared to other parts of the country. But our experiences here are quite varied. You know, acceptance isn't universal in other parts of the state, even in larger, you know, LGBTQI plus communities. And an accepting culture doesn't automatically mean equitable outcomes. There can still be gaps in healthcare, you know, experiences with discrimination, housing instability, things like that. And there's also just a pretty significant cultural shift happening right now that is hitting our trans and queer communities hard. And it's important to, you know, not assume that everyone is doing okay just because we're in Oregon. And so it's really to kind of gather like a full portrait and picture of like what are Two-Spirit and LGBTQI plus lives in Oregon really looking like. You know, where are people feeling, where are people finding safety, belonging? Are they able to access the resources, you know, that we need and things like that, so that we can, you know, we're included as a part of the picture to like have access to the very services and things that impact us.
So you touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to ask specifically how Pride in Numbers is different from other surveys collecting data about Two-Spirit and LGBTQ plus folks.
Yeah, so we are a community-led statewide project. So kind of the way that we're pursuing and conducting research and outreach does differ a little bit. So we had a community leadership team, which was a group of folks from across the state with, you know, majority from non-urban, non-Portland metro area, BIPOC folks, queer and trans folks, just all of us like from across the state with a variety of different lived experiences and identities that were kind of shaping this project. We were being really mindful about how to like conduct this research and engage in outreach in a way that feels like in relationship and in community with one another rather than feeling extractive. And it's been really neat because a lot of the ways that we're conducting research, like our qualitative research, we have a community art project and that art will also be a part of data analysis as well as storytelling sessions and interviews that kind of bring depth and nuance to what we're gathering through the survey.
What is your vision for all of the data that you collect?
The goal is, you know, long-term transformative change. Our hope, you know, is that whatever we collect goes back out to the community. So it'll be sent to, you know, be posted on our social media, shared in our newsletters, posted on our website. We want it out there for everyone possible to use to build, you know, the services and things like that they need. And so our hope is that it helps kind of, you know, shift power and build communities where our needs are centered rather than overlooked.
Totally. This makes me think about the importance of people taking the Pride in Numbers survey, particularly rural communities and BIPOC communities. Could you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when folks say like something is statewide, sometimes it's really referring to, you know, an org or a group or a gathering of people trying to provide services statewide, but, you know, really not having connections in rural spaces or things like that. And so we have partnerships with folks across all kinds of different regions and in counties. And we know, you know, Two-Spirit and LGBTQI life does not stop at city limits. And so we want to, and we know like life looks different for people across Oregon. It's not going to look the same depending on where someone's located. I mean, I'm located in Eugene and I know my life with my intersections of my specific identities looks really different than for a queer person in Oregon. And so it's really important that we have like an accurate representation of what, you know, people's lives look like with these intersections of these different lived experiences and identities.
Thinking about all of that, have y'all talked about or anticipated some limitations of the data?
I think it depends on the amount of responses we get, because what we're able to share out is really dependent on what people share with us. And so, you know, we want to be really mindful about whatever we're sharing back out and reporting, like not being identifiable to anyone, but also having enough detail in reporting that people are able to see what they want to see in regards to their particular communities. And so what we want to and what we're able to share out is really, really only dependent on the amount of engagement that we get, which is why it's so important for people to participate. And I know personally, like as a pansexual person, like living in Oregon, I know my nervous system is feeling the effects of what's happening like every single day, all day. And so kind of all of those security and privacy things are always at the kind of forefront of our mind as we're thinking through this work every day. And so that's why all of our research is like really agency and consent based. So part of the survey is a required question besides screener questions. There's no obligation to complete it. If you don't want to, you can skip any question. For interviews and storytelling sessions, we've had folks like, you know, something interviews be like a little long to go hours long. And so it's entirely based on how long someone wants to be in that space sharing.
Yeah, I've taken the Pride in Number survey and I had follow-up questions based on the answers that I gave. And so you shared a little mm-hmm. bit about this. If you could go into depth about what a survey taker might experience while taking the survey.
So there's a bunch of different domains that we ask questions regarding: healthcare, housing, belonging, safety, all kinds of things. And there's different, like multiple choice and things like that, questions regarding them. And then there's also spaces for people to share, like open space for people to share answers and expand on any of the things that they described or any identity and demographic questions. And so no one has to fill out any portion of short answer if they don't want to. And that can be as long or as short as they want it to be. And the survey takes around 20 minutes to complete from what we've heard from folks.
There might be some folks who are hesitant to take the survey. Is there anything that you would like them to know?
We think about data security and protections all of the time. And we do have a 6-page long document available on our website that kind of outlines how we are protecting people's data and information on the survey through storytelling sessions and interviews, as well as the community art project. And there's an email listed there if anyone has any questions. It's us that you talk to directly. So, you know, if you go through like that 6-page document to decide for yourself if you would like to participate after having all of that information, like we're always, the team is always happy to talk to folks directly about any questions they may have too. And at the end of the day, it's completely up to you whether you want to participate in that research. But we do whatever we can to provide all of the information necessary for you to make an informed consent-based decision, like for yourself. Great. And I wanted to note, you know, we are wholly independent. So this means we don't share our raw data files with government, universities, or outside institutions. So our data is always securely stored, never sold, and only accessed by a handful of trusted researchers.
Yeah, I was reading on the website there are 3 people who have access to the data yeah. that's collected.
Yes.
Putting together this survey and executing it on this scale takes a lot of effort, and I'm curious about what makes this project worthwhile to you.
I think what feels really special to me is like the whole process for even figuring out how we were going to design the survey anyways and go into parts of outreach. I personally am like really interested in qualitative research and just think like the way from my own personal like academic background have found that really interesting, and I really like our process of how we've conducted outreach and participated in that research. So we have field researchers across the state who've conducted like storytelling sessions and events in their own communities. And so it's a really cool process because we're providing training tools and resources for people in their own communities to engage other people in their communities, because people know how to do that best. Like I know my area and my people and the ways to approach that with respect and with care and caution best. And it feels a lot less, you know, extractive than someone else coming in, gathering data and then leaving, rather than like being in community with the people that are in those spaces in the first place. And so that's something that's felt really special to me. And being able to like help partners make connections across the state. And, you know, as we've talked to someone in one county about a resource they're trying to get started, we think about someone else that we know who's had that resource running for years. And we've actually been able to like connect different community partners and groups with each other to have conversations together about how they can either collaborate to meet a need in their community or just like get advice or support around a specific resource or program.
Where can our listeners find out more about Pride in Numbers?
PrideInNumbers.org is the best place to find out more about Pride in Numbers. We also have a newsletter that you can access and sign up for through our website. We have our social media, Pride in Numbers Oregon, on Facebook and on Instagram.
Any final thoughts?
No, thank you so much for having us here just to talk more about Pride in Numbers and the work we're doing. And yeah, we really appreciate it.
That was KBOO's in-depth news reporter, G, speaking with Namisha Jane about Pride in Numbers. You can find out more about Pride in Numbers' current survey at prideinnumbers.org.
You're tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs